Hey, good morning. On Tuesday, March 13th, 2012, you are listening to Brian and Gabe Live. I'm Brian Madden from San Francisco. Thanks, everyone, for joining today.
What, do we let Justin run the song? I mean, we didn't even get to the good part where we got to say O-H and I-O.
Yeah, well, I think we are coming quickly up on our 30-second legal limit of being allowed to play songs.
Right.
Well, the bitchy buck guy is Gabe Knuth, sitting in Omaha.
Yes, thank you for joining, Gabe. And Jack is here in the studio with us.
Good morning.
And our guest today, Harry Labana.
Good morning. I'm glad it worked out because I know we've been trying to get this on the road for a couple of months now. And, you know, it's a good excuse. Otherwise, last night I would have been stuck at home, forced to watch the finale of The Bachelor with my wife. So thank you for having me.
Yeah, yikes. yeah, and thanks for coming up here. It's a rainy day in San Francisco, which, you know, coming from the East Coast, you know, you need a good foot and a half of snow before people stop. You know, they drive in at 60 miles an hour instead of 80 if you have more than a foot of snow. And here the clouds, you know, the sky turns, instead of blue, turns dark blue, and then immediately there's 45
people
accidents.
Don't know how to drive.
Yeah. So today we're talking about our industry, I guess. I don't know if we have a specific sort of a agenda. I know we've got the chat room running. Hopefully you all can hear us, no problem. And what happened this week? We've got Microsoft talking to OnLive. We've got Bri Forum sessions. We've got what else? Our book is done. Harry's here. So what do you guys want to talk about first?
Man, let me tell you, writing crickets. A book is kind of a pain in the ass.
Okay, yeah. So we talked about the book in the past. I think we've talked about the book in past weeks. You know, our book is called The VDI Delusion, and the subtitle is Why Desktop Virtualization Failed to Live Up to the Hype and What the Future Enterprise Desktop Will Really Look Like. Now, when I walked in the studio here, I heard Harry saying, like, to Jack, something about people need to stop whining about how much VDI sucks.
Yes.
What's that about?
Well, I think we're a little bit schizophrenic, right, in our industry. And what I really mean by that is I think we're not really looking at it objectively, right? So on one hand, we're complaining that Microsoft is not giving us licenses to do desktop as a service. On the other hand, Brian, pardon my French, but you know, you're arguing that it's too expensive, we should just do terminal services, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, having done it and having kind of seen the various kind of, you know, the blogs and the various articles out there, my view is that you really have to kind of ask yourself, when people talk to me about VDI, to do or not to do VDI, what it really becomes is a question of what's your central compute strategy, right? And that all sounds very fluffy, but what does that really mean, right? So, you know, all this cloud stuff that's going on, I mean, what are you doing about central compute? So is VDI just a part of that strategy, or are you really thinking about it as a patching problem? Because really, if you're thinking about desktops as something that's going to solve patching, and that's as ignorant as you are about the desktop world and where it's going, then I'm sorry, you're just ignorant about it. So I think the delusion is that people don't understand where the world is going, right? And I'm quite happy to get into some specifics there, if you like.
Of course we like. And, you know, we have in the book, we talk about to be clear, also, it's the title is The VDI Delusion, not The Desktop Virtualization Delusion. And we early on sort of look at what the promises of VDI were over the past 5 or 6 years and then get into what the reality is. And two of the biggest realities that I talk about and I've talked about in the past are that, one, I don't believe that VDI is about saving money, because any tricks you do with VDI to save money would also apply to the traditional desktop world. And two, I don't believe that VDI is about making things more easy to manage. I don't believe that VDI is about management savings. I do believe that VDI is about enabling new capabilities and meeting, you know, new needs you might have to deliver Windows applications. So I wonder if that falls in what you're saying about...
So I think it's relative, right? So I think we're instantly dismissed that it doesn't save money. And we have to look at that from the context of what we're saying. So if you look at it as a pure apples-to-apples comparison compared to your physical desktop, I would agree with that sentiment. But when you add in, and as you rightly point out, the capabilities part of the discussion, then actually staying on physical, depending on the use case, can be a lot more expensive, right?
Agreed.
And actually disabling.
Because the VDI can allow you to deliver these new capabilities for a much lower cost than traditional PCs.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right. And then on the management side, right, and I think it's a question of, agreed, not yet. And you've probably seen me talking about it. I always talk about, well, go one-to-one, right? If you really believe what Brian is saying, which I actually believe, I think the way to achieve it is to go one-to-one to start with. I think people try and smash together that it's going to be cheaper to manage and it's going to save money day one, and they just don't get it. And what
that's how it's sold to them, though.
And you know, I think the industry's guilty of I guess
embellishment.
Embellishment. Yeah, that's probably the right word.
It's the nicest one.
Well, yeah, and so and I'm with you. I mean, the one to one, because if you need, I like that because that's the lowest jump into VDI. If you go one to one, that's how you have it today. And by the way, for me, one to one, I don't even care about users having admin rights. If you have admin rights with your users today, move it into your VDI. If your users don't have admin rights, I still probably want one to one, so that way each user can have the most unique, you know, their applications and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, I would disagree with that and say that if you do want, if you have admin rights on your PC infrastructure that you can infect your PC, you move those admin rights into the data center right next to your app and data and compute infrastructure.
But so
you,
I mean,
you
I
probably
gotta,
created a problem there.
But if my firewall is around the data center and I put my users inside the firewall, that's my own dumbass fault.
Well, I think, you know.
But wouldn't somebody intelligently, like when they're designing something like this, wouldn't they still put some sort of barrier in between the user land network and the actual data and applications? I mean, it could be fairly permissive, much like what you would normally have, I guess. You know, what the users out in the floor with traditional desktops today aren't, you know, I guess in a lot of situations they probably do have carte blanche access into the data center, but they shouldn't.
Sure.
Wouldn't that practice carry forward into VDI as well?
Sure. So you could certainly take that approach, right? But to me, it's a higher risk profile because you're putting everything centralized. So it's much easier to get from one place to the next, right? So, I mean, you talk about security. I mean, I'd argue that app virtualization is one of the greatest security risks that nobody's talking about out there.
You talk about that right now. What do you mean?
So let's just talk about, you know, how we think about security traditionally, right? We think about perimeter security, firewalls, data center, the PC, physical access. And, you know, app virtualization is not designed to be a security solution. It's another thing embellished by the industry that it's a security benefit.
You mean app virtualization like the AppV and ThinApp and those kinds of things?
All
or
of
you mean
them,
like ZenApp?
Right, all of them, right? So because I think what I'm really talking about is the isolation capability, so the isolation sandbox. I mean, it's a hacker's dream, right? So if I can hack into the isolation sandbox, I have access to everything, right? So we really have to think about, I think, security, that there are all of these, I guess, perimeters that are available to us, and we have to protect in different ways. So you can't just sandbox just the PC or just the apps or just the data. You have to do kind of have sandboxes around all of them, because otherwise you're going to be rootkitted at different sandbox levels, and you're going to have quite a problem on your hands.
The rootkit, so now it's, you mean at different levels, because before the rootkit was on the hardware, but now I can root, I'm using air quotes here, with my camera, air quotes, the hypervisor, or I can root the app virtualization container, or...
Sure. You could buy a dodgy motherboard from China where there's hardware. It's already embedded in the hardware, and it's shipped.
Huh.
Right? So right? So you, I mean, just go Google it, right? Dodgy Chinese motherboards, right? And I'm sure you'll find stuff in hardware. And I think, right? So, I mean, where does that, you know, level of code come in? Can you get infected down at the BIOS level? And this whole point about kind of, you know, this trusted boot, how do you provide that in your environment moving forward? So I don't think it's just a question of just, do you have admin rights or do you not have admin rights? I think that just becomes just another layer of management that you have to worry about.
So do you think this trusted boot is a legit thing, like the people are going to need? Because I always figured it was just something that Intel did just to sell more Intel processors.
I thought it was a government thing. Yeah. Like,
well, and again, when I say trusted boot, I don't necessarily mean TXT, TPMs, right, and hardware always. But I think let's just take it even to the point around consumerization of IT, for example, right? You know, if you're going to have trusted containers which apps can execute on, or you want to put data in those containers, that's a different level of, I guess, containment, right? And I think the real question becomes from an enterprise perspective is how much do you trust that container? And one way to trust that container is to write it yourself, right? The other way is to buy it from somewhere which is not so dodgy, right? And again, there are multiple containers that you need to care about. Because if you look at, you know, a lot of the hackers out there, and the sophistication out there, you know, they will exploit multiple vulnerabilities at the same time. And that probably, you know, carries multi-million dollars worth of research. And those are usually state-funded levels of capability. So when I talk to a lot of my buddies in the enterprise, or kind of chief paranoia officers, as I call them, you know, they're really concerned about this, right? The level of sophistication and the capital that's available to get into the infrastructure.
Which the capital we provided by buying our sure. iPads and coffee makers.
Sure.
So you're now, you've been in Absence for, I don't know, like a year or something? Or?
Oh, about 10 months or so, yeah.
So how's that so far for you?
It's been great. I mean, you know, really we've kind of, you know, reshaping what Absence is about, what, you know, what we define, you know, Absence is going to be moving forward. And really kind of how we're thinking about, you know, the world at Absence is really about, you know, when we think about things like consumerization, VDI, terminal services, where we've come from, it's really about how do you enable people to work and kind of give them choice in how they want to work, because there's all this stuff that's available to you, right? And how do you enable that? And we're an enterprise company, so there's a lot of stuff out there, you know, the FUIT, consumerization of IT, but who's focusing on enterprise consumerization? How do we make that safe? How do we make that consumable in a, I guess, a sensible way with governance and compliance? And just one kind of additional point there, and I think from a, you know, from an ambition standpoint, right? It's because kind of the way I look at it is that we're at an interesting time, I guess, in history, and all these people have access to compute, right? So I remember when in previous jobs where we used to marvel at compute farms that we used to build to kind of have static workload analysis. But now I can get access to that with a credit card, right? And that's never happened before. So with all of this compute that's become available to people, there's this massive democratization that's happening. So how do you bring that to people, right, all over the planet, right, in a way that hasn't been done? What kind of services become possible? And I think just purely focusing on just consumerization is almost delusion. We should maybe write a second book, The Great Consumerization Delusion, right?
That sounds fine to me. That's your list, Jack.
Right. I think it has to be done in a way that's sensible, right? Otherwise, you're going to have all these interconnected devices. You've got all these hardware routing. And there's a lot of ignorance in the consumer world, right? Like, my mom has no idea about security, right? She's going to use whatever I tell her to use. And I think we have to make it consumable in a way where there's a set of rules. It's not just technology. There's also policy. And there's also, you know, there's governments have to behave and agree. So I think there's a much bigger issue here at large here.
So what is this? I mean, how do you tie that back to enterprises? Because you're talking about, you know, individuals have access to compute, and that's sort of all over the world, and anyone has access to those multiple powers, yeah. And we need to control. I mean, like, from an enterprise, if I'm an IT pro at a company,
yeah.
And I'm just trying to deal with my users and what's happening, like, what am I need to be thinking about?
Yeah, so I guess it depends on the type of enterprise you are, and we could probably take this in steps, right? So if I think about the, and I, you probably heard me say this before, but I think about the West, right? So Europe and the United States, and essentially we've got a lot of legacy here, right? Which is the reality. So we've got a lot of, you know, Windows PC infrastructure. We've got a lot of ignorant people in IT. We've got a lot of people asleep at the wheel, right? There's a lot of people who are kind of just going to protect their jobs. But you know, it's nothing to do with me, nothing to do with Absence, right? But I think the client architecture choices that are becoming available, so whether that's Windows 7, Windows 8, 32-bit, 64-bit, various types of app virtualization, terminal services, VDI, just within Windows is tremendous diversity. And I think, if anything, I would say from the VDI industry's perspective, even large enterprise customers, I think they're even saying, well, we won't necessarily always go wall-to-wall with VDI unless it's a very specific use case, but we'll maybe do some RDS, excuse me, terminal services, right? In my mind, they're still the same thing. And I think, how do you deal with that, right? So that's the first step in terms of if these different client architectures give you access to different types of use cases. Just take the Citrix receiver kind of example, right? So yes, I know you don't want to use it on your iPad to do things, but it's a Steam valve, right? It's just it's a bridge to the past, right? And it also enables new capabilities. So that's kind of step one. But then I think when you start to get into, well, what about all of these different cloud services, whether it's in data, whether they're new app types, right? And people want to just use them. And I think, I mean, since I've left Citrix, what do? Right? I mean, let's be for full disclosure, right? I use my Mac. I use everything on it, right? It's probably not encrypted. It's where I'd probably do all the bad things, right, that I'm not supposed to do. Do I have access to a desktop virtualization environment? Well, sort of, right? Does AppSense need to upgrade their infrastructure? Yes, but that's a different problem. So I want to work in ways on devices that I choose to, right? So on my Mac, I want to do certain things. Hey, when I want to connect into the network to do certain things like approve timesheets, budgets, some sensitive stuff, that's fine. My iPad has been stolen by my children, so I've given up. And my point being is, I think, so there's this diversity coming, right? So enterprises have to learn how to deal with this choice in a way that's governed and compliant. So I think from an enterprise, that touches every part of the enterprise, right? It touches how data is consumed, what happens to storage, the networks, the whole infrastructure has to be redesigned.
That's a tall order. So, yeah.
Well, if we can go into one of those particular things, Gabe and I were talking about yesterday and in the last week or so at CIT, yeah. We've been talking about various.
You got in eventually.
Five.
Oh no! Sorry, CIT is our internal name for our consumerized IT website.
Oh, okay. Right.
The conference. We were denied.
Oh, yeah. Well, that'd be CITE.
Yeah, the CITE conference.
I guess.
They denied us.
But we did, yeah.
Apparently you don't know anything about consumerization then.
No, we were all booted out of, because like they talk about the world's top experts on consumerization. So that's not us, because we were not allowed in. So anyway.
So we talked last week, and I have two more articles planned for this week about mobile file syncing solutions and basically Dropbox enterprise alternatives, unquote. Mm-hmm. Enterprise document management, and I'm sort of wondering, can those two things, can they even be the same product? Can you know, like philosophically, like your Dropbox that you just put stuff in every day, and you know, who cares if it's not secure? Maybe that can live alongside of your whatever crazy enterprise data management product can be. I don't know. Thoughts, guys?
Well, that's when we talked yesterday. That's when I mentioned the thing that the last time I talked to Harry was a briefing on that whole data locker thing from AppSense Labs. And so in that situation, you could use personal Dropbox and still encrypt the corporate data. That's where I feel like that maybe can be the same solution. And it literally can be the same. Like I'm still going to use Dropbox no matter what, because there's so many of these sync solutions out there now. I mean, everybody has one. There's a ton that aren't affiliated with people, the Sugar Syncs of the world, and I can't remember the other one. ShareFile is with Citrix now, and all of those guys, they're all about mobile, they're all about sync, they're all about doing the same thing. Just Dropbox is so damn simple, it just does it, and that's why people keep going back to it in spite of all these other ones existing.
Yes, okay. Since you, perhaps I'll give you maybe a minute on how kind of I think about this. I think the reality is you can't be prescriptive on saying that there's just going to be one way, right? That there's just one way to do this. So when we came up with DataLocker, I mean, the reality was, in our previous office when we were out in San Jose, even Brian came up for a visit. We just had a desk and a whiteboard many months ago, and it was just every time somebody would walk into the office, we'd turn it around and hide the whiteboard. And really, it was kind of like you guys. I was watching you guys set up, and you're using Dropbox to get ready for this show here, and that's fine, right? And we just basically said to ourselves, hey, that's kind of bad, because we're putting some pretty sensitive stuff out there, let's just figure out a way to encrypt it. That's really how DataLocker formed. But then we started to look kind of deeper at it and said, well, let's look at this from a user perspective. And also, at the end of the day, we're an enterprise company. Let's look at it from an IT perspective. And we said, well, what does the user care about, right? So why do people like me behave badly in the enterprise? Because I like to use my stuff locally, right? Because it's fast, it's performant, it's just there. I just like it, right? And that's okay. And then also, but at the same time, I want access to my stuff wherever it is. Right? But then from an IT perspective, IT doesn't want to retrain me in lots and lots of different tools. Right? So workflow becomes really, really important. And also IT, at the end of the day, as much as stick that we give IT and say we don't, at the end of the day, what is IT's job? It's to protect the enterprise, right? Because there are laws and rules. And even if you're a user, if you're in a regulated industry, you couldn't just say, I don't care. So what we decided, and this is kind of a Brian Madden exclusive. It's the first time we've actually spoken about this publicly, but we've been thinking in our absence, you know, how do we solve this problem? And so we've been working on something internally called Project Orca. And what Orca is, Project Orca is all about how do you get enterprise access to data in different places, right, at its highest level. Right? And what we've said is, well, you know, at the end of the day, I put stuff in Dropbox, but if I'm in a enterprise, where is a lot of my valuable data today? Right. A lot of it still is in the enterprise because of information leakage, right? I'm not allowed to take it out. So the real problem is not necessarily encryption day one, right? The problem is I want to access my data, right? So even if I have a corporate managed laptop, for example, I probably still have to VPN from a corporate managed laptop which has full disk encryption. And we thought about that and we said, how ridiculous is that? Because if I give you my iPhone right now, what can you really do with it, right? It's 256-bit encrypted, right? If you do 3 password attempts on it, it's going to crack it. I'm sure you could.
How many digits long is your password?
Sorry?
How many digits long is your password?
4.
out of curiosity, do you use a product to lock down the iPhone, and that's just built into the...
No, we just use ActiveSync policies for email, and then 3 bad attempts, it's done. But the iPhone in itself is an encrypted device, right? It has encryption. So if you think about it, right, so you've got my little passcode, you've got active sync policy, you've got a couple of kilobit switches, and email's okay there, right? And okay, fine, it's not a financial services level of security, and that's where you'll look at solutions like Good. But for us, it's great. Right? I'm not going to VPN in from that. So why not apply that same kind of logic initially to laptops? So when we thought about Orca, we were saying, well, why can't I access my home drive at home? How cool would that be, right?
Yeah.
Or extend my home drive to anywhere. And to do that, right, we'd really have to be able to access that from different kinds of clients. We'd have to access it in a secure way. And really, 3 principles came up. And John Wallace, who was number one, I think, presenter at BriForum last year.
That is correct. AppSense had, I think, 3 out of the top 5 on rankings of best presenters.
Yeah.
I was not among the top 5.
Yeah, so I remember this frantic call from John Wallace, and he was saying, Harry, I think I've got it. I think I know what to do with this. And we had kind of had this long conversation, and we started to think about design principles of what this thing should do. And one of the first ones we said, look, what's really, really important is workflow, because there is no way IT is going to spend money to retrain users to access their home drive. So whatever we do, we're not going to go and put stubs of data on there or new drives, right? It has to work with what they already have, right? So it has to be transparent, right? Irrespective of the client they're coming into, it has to feel like a native client. So that was kind of principle number one. Principle number two, it has to be about, let's just solve an access problem, V1, right? So V1, let's kind of think about how you get access. Let's build a virtual appliance, right? So we built a secure Linux CentOS virtual appliance, which you can actually connect to the infrastructure, doing various levels of authentication. And then the third principle is really about governance, right? So, you know, what is AppSense really? It's really a governance, compliance, and policy company, right? When you really peel it back. And that's why people buy AppSense. And what they really want is to be able to extend that governance and compliance to the data that they're applying. So, you know, we formulated this project, Project Orca. We've been, working away busily on it, and you know, we will see where we take that. So our view is that Orca today is just an extension of your home drive home, but tomorrow.
So with desktop clients and mobile clients,
yep.
Except, you know, it's on obviously on your home drive and not on. Who knows where?
Well, today, the way we're thinking about it is less. What we're doing is, again, we're trying to solve the problem for the enterprise, right? So, I mean, a lot of people have an access problem to their enterprise data, right? Let's just think about folder redirection is a great example, right? So, people do folder redirection, right? It sucks, right? Folder redirection, no matter what people tell you, it's not very good. But tomorrow, if that same infrastructure can also connect you to different cloud repositories, why can't it become a bridge, right? So you can choose, right? So, hey, you know what? If you want to use Dropbox because it's easy, it's simple, well, use it, right? We know we can do it, right? And we proved that with DataLocker. Tomorrow it could be Box, it could be ShareFile, it could be SkyDrive, right? I think for us, we did not want to get into the data business, right? We are not going to go and be a SaaS data storage provider. what we wanted to do is, like, you know, people want access from a, you know, kind of, we call it the kind of the user virtualization, people-centric platform, right? But that whole enterprise consumerization piece is really about getting access to the stuff that you need. So that's what we're really interested in, right? Not getting into becoming a data storage repository company.
So Orca right now is a service that runs in the data center then?
Orca, as in the prototypes that we have for it, it would be something that you would put in your DMZ, right? Again, okay. You could put it inside your network and VPN to it, which kind of defeats the purpose, right? But right. You could do that. But it's a secure Linux appliance. There'll be more information on what that is. So John Wallace is actually going to post a blog on some of the Orca concepts probably after this show, and we'll release more details over the coming weeks. So I'd certainly watch his blog on the AppSense CTO blog. But the idea would be that you know the client securely communicate over HTTPS, right, with this infrastructure that can then talk to your existing storage repositories without modification. Right? And then you can then apply some policy initially to deal with kind of the common use cases. Right. So initially, the first use case we're going for is just like, just give me access to my stuff at home in an easier way across multiple clients.
So is this kind of, I mean, conceptually like what VMware's doing with Octopus or Res Hyperdrive?
So I think for us, the key differentiators are we are not requiring you to change your existing storage. Right. So again, I don't want to speak for Res because I don't claim to be an expert in their technology. But my understanding of it is that you're required to create a hyperdrive stub on the infrastructure. So you'd have to use that as your storage repository. Right. So, we took the approach of build this ground up. Right. We didn't go and, go and think about potentially getting this technology from elsewhere. Because we built it from ground up, we can take it in any direction we want. We could choose to do that. That was the simplest route. We instead decided to simply leave the storage unmodified. So we had to do things like virtualize the file system so our clients look and feel. If I showed you the Mac client, it looks like a Mac. You couldn't tell. It's Finder. If I showed you the Windows client, it looks like Explorer.
So it's kind of like, so the user experience is sort of like Dropbox, but the secure virtual appliance that you have is sort of like a proxy almost for taking your regular file storage in the back.
Think of it as a user hub.
I don't know what that means.
So think of it as, my clients talk to this user hub, right? This hub then gets me services. And the service that's available today is your enterprise home directory. Tomorrow, it could also be your Dropbox folder.
Okay,
And so on and so forth, right?
But so the question is, so that's relying on an organization's existing storage capabilities. And if they're small and if they're slow, and if a user is on the other side of the world and they're going all the way back to their corporate headquarters 5,000 miles away, that user is going to go get Dropbox.
And they can, right? So we're again, at the end of the day, when we looked at this, right, we're not trying to become a consumer company, right? So if Dropbox does great stuff, right, we use it, right? So if people want to integrate Dropbox into their workflow at work, and this is what I mean by enterprise consumerization, then by all means, do it, right? So if your requirement is that you need to encrypt your files in Dropbox to do it and you need some policy on that, right, we would enable that, right? We're not going to be the CDN for it. Will our virtual appliance, do more redundancy and scalability in future? Absolutely. But today, look, it's just most of our customers, when we speak to them, they said, offline folders sucks. Help us out. Can we get access to our existing enterprise data on our iPads, right? Our iPhones, our Android devices, and the answer to that is, well, conceptually yes, and we're working on that.
Okay, so for those in the chat room who wants to change the topic, I was curious about what this stuff
is. We need to catch up on this whole conversation in the chat room here.
Yeah, so I can't read and listen at the same time. So those of you who say, can we please change the subject? You tell me what subject you want to have next, because I see conversations about how much Windows 8 was going to suck and why Microsoft is still screwing us.
We missed a bunch of lines of chat in here
in the enterprise agreements, but give us a new topic. Incidentally, the online, so like let's quickly shifting gears 100%. I am curious, so I don't know if we want to do like some bets or whatever. When Microsoft announced that OnLive was not in compliance with a licensing agreement, my first reaction was, okay, well, OnLive is like they were just being ignorant or stupid or arrogant and they missed it or whatever. But now the more people I talk to and I've over the past week, I'm starting to wonder if OnLive feels like they actually found a loophole. So it wasn't that OnLive was being ignorant or ignorant. It wasn't like they were like they just didn't know any better. It's like they actually sort of scoured the license agreement that they had and decided that they felt like they found a loophole, which is why they're being quiet on it. So Microsoft, of course, Microsoft is going to say they're not in compliance, but you know, Microsoft says they're not in compliance. Mm-hmm. OnLive says we are in compliance, and let the courts sort that out. So I don't know. What do you guys? I'm curious to the audience as well as to Gabe and others. I don't know. What do you guys think about where we are with OnLive?
You and I talked about this yesterday, and it was one of those classic. Man, we had a really awesome conversation about it. And now we're going to try to recreate it thing. Although we're not. So my inclination, like having met with OnLive's CEO and asked the questions directly, I really think that they. If there was some sort of agenda, there's no way in hell they let on. Like, that guy should quit all this CEO bullshit and become an actor. because the answers that we got were more along the lines of just kind of like, yeah, we got licensing guys. They're on it. And by the way, check out all this cool demo. Look, we have a fast internet connection, but we don't really. It's a slow one. And so it was just very – I feel like they either didn't know or were circumventing it on purpose. But maybe that backs up what you're saying, that, you know, they're doing it on purpose to prove something. But I don't know why if they're trying to prove something, I don't know why they're not being more public about that.
Well, I don't think they're – I mean, they might have
– they're doing it because they think they found a loophole and they're trying to dispute Microsoft. Right now, the ball's in Microsoft – like the needle is favoring Microsoft on the scale of who's winning, you know, because Microsoft is like, hey, they're not in compliance. So why isn't OnLive being out there saying, hey, come on, man, like, you know, there's a loophole here.
But
and
they
we
could have a confidentiality.
Maybe
they have a confidentiality agreement with Microsoft on the license because they had to sign some deal with Microsoft because they provide Windows games.
And yeah, so but then how can Microsoft? Yeah, well, that's another thing altogether.
I think it might be a loophole.
If they're in violation, I think that Windows games business might be affected as well. But if there's a confidentiality agreement, Microsoft can go out there and talk about how OnLive's not in compliance, but OnLive can't talk about how they're not.
Yeah, I think it was a giant cock-up, frankly, because yeah. I think this is an assumption that because we can do it for games, they have a very capital-intensive business because they're dedicated hardware. So I don't know how you actually build a business out that way. So one way to do that is to increase volume. Massively, and you know, it's kind of natural to say, "Hey, just do it for desktops as well." That's a new workload which we can add to this business of dedicated hardware. I think it's virtualization that got them into trouble.
And they had the hardware sitting there not doing anything during the day while people were at work and not gaming. So you know, I think they were trying to think of a way to leverage all that capacity that was just sitting there doing nothing.
Let's go, and this is kind of from the comments, and yes, I do like bacon, so this is live, although that, I know that you said that 10 minutes ago. Harry, do you think, I mean, and the reason I ask you is because, you know, we only have you today, and we talk about this, you know, almost every week, I feel like, but sure. Microsoft, a lot of the stuff that the OnLive conversation really illustrates is that, you know, Microsoft does limit VDI. In the use cases, because you know they've got SPLA for, you know, RDS, but not for Windows 7, and they have just all the stuff around. It's very hard. Like, what do you think Microsoft's deal is that makes them not want to make it easy for everyone to use Windows 7 via VDI?
Well, again, I don't have any inside track to Microsoft, but I'll give you my personal view.
Yes,
on
please.
It, right. So my personal view on this is that I think some of it is that. You know, how's the argument being presented back to Microsoft, right? And I think a lot of the argument for VDI, right? So the you know, embellishment from the industry is it saves you money. So if I was Microsoft and you said, hey, you want to save money, I would say, oh, then use either have
yeah,
a better managed
terminal server.
Yeah, use terminal server or have a better managed PC. So I think right. The conversation really has to be had with Microsoft is, look, this is all about a move to central compute, right? It's, you know, whether you want to do your Azure thing, you know, is the Windows 9 theme all a move to Azure? How does the Windows client business fit into that? And does it? And quite frankly, to be fair to Microsoft, right? Look, it's their business, right? And if they're choosing with look, I was watching TV last night, and you know, there's all these really cool now. You know, Zintel calls them ultrabooks, right? It's almost like MacBook Air, like Windows machines. They're kind of cool machines,
almost
right? But you know, so why not, right? Why not have both? And I think their focus, frankly, is on Windows 8 being focused on the client side. And I think their view is have a better managed desktop if you want cheaper. And I don't think anyone's had the right conversation with them yet.
Do you think
there's a lot of people that have been saying that Windows 8, you know, there's going to be some changes there. There's a comment in the chat room about Windows 8 having a VDI broker, this Windows 8 server. But then also that maybe Microsoft is waiting for Windows 8 for some sort of major licensing change or something like that. And I personally don't think that that's a catalyst for anything. I think what you just said is correct. I think Windows 8 is about the user. But, I mean, do you see anything to those rumors of licensing changes?
I personally don't see any reason for them to do that yet.
Why? Right.
Why do they care about DAS? I'll ask that question.
Yeah, I agree. That's a good question to ask. Incidentally, but what are they saying about in the chat room about Windows 8 having a VDI broker? I mean, Windows 2008 has a VDI broker now. What's different?
RDS.
Well, that's the RDS broker. Like, this is specifically remember how convoluted that thing is.
Well. Yeah, but I mean, you know, terminal server by itself has been convoluted since 1998.
Well, but that's taking the terminal server broker and using that for VDI desktops, and so this is more focused on
VDI
desktops.
What's the difference?
It's not nearly as complex. Yeah, but it's the idea is that it's not nearly as complex. Remember, I mean, come on, that thing was really, really shitty. Like, it was just like, hey, we have this thing that brokers things, and we can virtualize desktops. Let's see if we can shoehorn these things in to work with each other. And sure enough, if you get a big enough hammer,
did you
describe
Zen Desktop?
Well, yeah. If you get a big enough hammer, that square peg will fit in that round hole. And that's what the current broker solution is like. And so I think that this is going to be more tailor made. That said, I don't think it'll have any effect on anything. It's a broker. Like, come on, this is the in all of the VDI space, a broker is a broker, man. Like, who gives a shit? Like, you know, if it wasn't good enough and you were hell-bent on using just Microsoft technology, go get LeoStream or something. Like, come on.
Incidentally, I talked to LeoStream yesterday, and they, you know, it's been like a year since I talked to them, and I was pretty impressed. So they have a DAS offering now also, except theirs is based on AWS. So they took their connection broker, and, you know, they're still... they're still plugging away at doing all these sort of like, I don't know what you want to call it. I don't want to say long tail, but like the last, you know, people are using them in combination with Zen Desktop and Vue, where there's just some, you need this security integration or this component or this type of redirection or something like that. So they're doing well as an add-on to add more capabilities to these two platforms. But they took their broker and stripped out a lot of that sort of enterprise specific stuff and built like a cloud scalable broker. And now they're selling DAS desktops based on AWS, which is kind of cool for them because they don't have to have any infrastructure. So, you know, I guess in that sense, I don't know if that's a competitor.
I think Jack wrote about that.
Yeah, I did.
Oh, well, good for you. I definitely read that.
Welcome to 5 months ago.
okay, well, it's people, you know.
No, I don't know when it was. But
and
yeah,
it's based on RDS,
using
by the way.
Aracom or something?
Yeah, well, that's another thing, too. So they're using, for the HTML5, interface for HTML5 client, they're using Aracom's Access Now, which is another thing. I feel like Aracom, both Aracom and LeoStream, you know, having sort of second tier capabilities and lower pricing, that's a hard thing to compete against Citrix and VMware and all these folks on. So I like that both LeoStream and Aracom are sort of picking out specific things. Like Aracom has been very successful with their HTML5 client, and they've licensed it to VMware, they've licensed it to I take it back. They integrate it with VMware, and they've licensed VMware's specifications so they can make a version for VMware Vue. They've licensed it to Quest. They've licensed it to LeoStream. So I feel like they're doing pretty well there. And I like that LeoStream has also found a little niche that can enable them to be successful.
And how do you think they fare in a world of VDI in a box?
LeoStream?
Yeah, all those guys. So with Dell doing the virtual appliance with VDI in a box. And you got all of the kind of systems integrator motion. So do you think they get broader traction?
That's a good question because, you know, historically, I've always felt that if you have a sort of smaller VDI environment, you shouldn't even try and do it yourself because you can't do it more cheaply than someone like Destone. And where that could potentially change is these integrators, or I mean, is like people like Dell who can offer you literally in a box, not the Citrix VDI in a box product, but
pod.
Actually, yeah, a literal pod you can drop in and it says, this gives me X desktops for X dollars and does everything that they need.
Yeah, I mean, which kind of, I don't know if you're familiar with Open Compute, the Open Compute project, right? So it's I think that could have a lot of relevance potentially for VDI. What that is, it's a data center open source project from Facebook where they're basically saying, let's open source hardware. So they've got commodity chassis designs, chassis power supplies. What's missing there is a storage specification. And I think what's going to be interesting is if they announce storage in May at San Antonio at their next conference.
Who's at Facebook's conference? It's
an open thing, yeah. They started, and I think Intel's on the board and various other people. And I think that becomes, it's all about commoditization of hardware. And I really think that could help solve a lot of this VDI cost, right? So we talked earlier about VDI is expensive, but at the end of the day, it's expensive because a lot of the data center components are expensive. And if we can solve those with more open source hardware, I think that's a really interesting area to watch.
That would be sweet. And Thomas, we'll get to your question in a minute. This kind of goes back to the session that Chetan Venkatesh did at Briform 2010, where he was talking about more VDI, more desktops moving to VDI because Moore's Law applies to the data center, but Moore's Law doesn't really apply to physical desktop hardware. I mean, because, yeah, sure, it does, but, like, what do you get from that? So today's $700 PC is twice as fast as what it was 2 years ago, but so what? Windows is still Windows, still to be managed the same way, et cetera. But if you look at, and even we can look at since you gave that session 2 years ago, I mean, probably back then we were 60 VDI sessions per host, and now we're like 150 per server, and it's just going up and up and up. And now we're seeing, we've got like single instance block level storage, which is starting to emerge, and these ways of doing all those kinds of things, I guess, where we actually can get to the point where we have some more, what I want to say, like certainty around our ability to deliver desktops out of the data center. And I guess that goes back to if I've got Windows applications and I need to provide that secure environment for my users to run, if I can do it in the data center cheap enough and that works for a lot of my use cases, then why not?
I agree.
So Thomas asked a couple of questions. This cloud powered roaming, it's available with iCloud. Windows 8 will serve the same customer. Oh, that's not the comments I was looking for, because Microsoft talked about in Windows 8 some profile.
Cloud roaming user profile. Yeah, the user account roaming.
Yeah. Do you know about that? I mean, what's the story with that? Because isn't that kind of like, it felt like that was like, why did I just forget the name? The logging consultants. Flex profiles. It looks like almost like a flex profile.
Yeah. So I do know about it. Some of it I'm still under disclosure from Microsoft.
Okay.
But I think, look, in general, I don't think it's inconceivable if you just look out there, right? So my live ID, right? And you look at my, iCloud ID, right? So I think all of these companies are trying to tie you into the various services they offer, right?
We're talking about two different things then, right?
And that's what Simon Townsend commented. That's the one that I think you were reading. Like, this is serving the same customer as iCloud.
Oh, I got you. Yeah, I was reading it right. Those letters are really little on the screen.
from where I'm sitting. We can't change it. We need a new chat platform.
Yeah, we do. But anyway, so there's two things. Number one, I think Microsoft is making like an XML, and this is like, I'm not under NDA with them, and I should say I did not learn this under NDA either. But this you can read about out there that there's sort of like an XML. It's called like Park Slope or something like that, or Park something, where it's something that. There's like an XML import-export specification for profile settings.
Yeah, and I think, again, so when it comes to things like that, right, I think ultimately anything Microsoft does there in the platform is good, because what they're really saying is that this better level of management in the platform is a good thing. But I think, again, if you're going to be in the business of exporting XML files, right, and then extending that with PowerShell and other things, I think that's fine for a type of use case, but when you want to really get to enterprise scale, you want to talk about more control, you want to do more triggers, conditions, and actions, right? It's a lot more advanced. who I think, if they did something like that, would it potentially affect? It commoditizes a lot of the profile-only vendors. I think they're the guys who should be sweating in their shoes right now.
A couple other things, and the comments about apps on Strata, and this is actually leads to a good conversation about user-installed apps.
Yeah, my favorite conversation, yes.
Okay, so I go back and forth on user-installed apps and layering. I mean, even layering itself. You know, we had Ron on the show a few weeks ago, and philosophically, and this is – I don't think we've written about this yet, but I have to ask the question philosophically, does – like, why does layering exist? Is it a management thing? Is it a user personalization thing? Is it a security thing? Like, what's the reason for layering existing? And then does that lead into this whole, like, user-installed apps thing? Is that –
yeah,
how big of a deal is that?
So I'll give you my two cents on that, right? So when Unidesk actually got their funding from Battery Ventures, Chris Midler, we met him. They were talking about composite virtualization. So I'm a big believer in abstraction at all levels so you can solve for different problems, right? So I think layers are valid, right, for some use cases, right? I don't believe that layers is the new panacea for desktop management, right?
Yeah.
I don't think it's going to solve everything, right? I think, and again, Don, right, Bullen and Ron, great guys, the utmost respect for them, and I think they will find their niche, but I don't think that's going to be the next revolution in PC management.
Which their niche seems to be about application deployment, which maybe is that synonymous with PC management?
Well, again, right, so I don't want to discourage them, right? Yeah. I always like people to push the envelope. I think it's hard, right? Look, the way the world works, unfortunately, right? Love it or hate it, you have to learn to live side by side with other infrastructures, right? So there will be other players, or Microsoft, right? They own the operating system. They set the rules. And if the rules are they want you to go to AppV and they do things in the operating system, I think it's a tough battle unless you have a specific use case. And again, right, I give Unidesk and their guys credit because they keep plugging along. Now, specifically around user-installed apps, I don't think user-installed apps is a technical solution. I think it's what you know. Simon Townsend actually describes it really well as a challenge, right? And really, what it is to me, it's this long tail of apps that are not necessarily packaged, right? They're unmanaged, or I think specifically from an AppSense perspective, Strata apps when we release it for free, it's going to be initially focused on client use cases because one of the things that we've heard is that look. I've got all of these laptops. We don't care about VDI. And what we want to do is try and remove admin rights so we can manage the image using System Center or any other tools that we use. And we just need some flexibility and freedom for users, right? So we're like, great. So Strata apps could do that. And I think then if you then take, and that's one of the challenges, right? So that's also user installed apps, but it's not maybe user installed apps. It's user managed apps. It's what you're saying is that IT is going to get out of the business of managing those apps for some use cases. So why not? I mean, you should be allowed to do user-installed apps, even if you're using a corporate build, because you know how, right? So why shouldn't I enable you, right, in a safe way? Now, if you want to do that in the data center in a VDI context, right, then that requires more control, right, and more management. And that's a different part of the challenge, right? So,
and a lot of this, I guess, is we want users to be able to have the ability perhaps to install their own things, but we also don't want to lose the ability to manage the desktop in the way that we're managing it.
Well, in some cases, we absolutely should lose the ability to manage the desktop. It's part of the ignorance of IT holding on to existing job functions, right? So I'm quite happy to debate anybody on that, right? Because there's a lot of, it's because this is the way we already do it. This is the way we think we need to do it. Again, why not enable users to, hey, if they screw up, you just reset the user-installed apps layer and you're done. Reinstall them, right? Why offer that service level for all use cases? Right? So do you want to be in the business of managed apps or unmanaged apps? If you want to be in the business of managed apps, guess what? There's a set of rules you've got to play by. End of story.
Oh, yeah. So you can like opt out. It's like opting out of your health insurance. So, I mean, if I want to opt out of IT managing my apps, I can do that. But I can't go crying back to them when I break something.
Yeah, and I think so. To me, you know, multiple app layers, right? If you talk about pure layers companies, I think that's a. I mean, I personally think that's a much harder problem to solve. Now you can argue, you know, but we haven't seen much of it. But ultimately, Microsoft sets the rules there, and I think from a Strata perspective, you know, our view is you play side by side with AppV, you work with System Center, you don't try and pretend you're going to solve app delivery because that's not what it's designed to do. It's really again. We're a user virtualization company. It's all about enabling new kinds of use cases. That's all.
So you talked about, you know, ITs for wanting to protect their jobs, yeah. And I'm curious. So I was in Boston this last week, yeah. Just for the weekend, actually. I spoke at the VertG, it's a virtualization user group in Boston, Tim Mangan, and I forget the other folks who put that on. I apologize to all you who I just met last. It was on a Saturday, incidentally. They had like 200 people there. Mm-hmm. But by the way, so they gave me a gift, which is to protect me because of my blog post about how I'm leaving the MVP program and everything. So they gave me a gift to protect against Microsoft. And I have this here. If you can see, if you're watching the web feed, it's a shield and a suit, like armor, you know, to protect me from Microsoft. Incidentally, we have these shelves in the background. I don't think you can see them behind Jack. We have on the shelves right now in our background. I've got the Briform binary clock from the first Briform in 2005. I've got the puppets that we used for our April Fool's show last year. I've got our Briform bobbleheads, different posters and stuff. I've got my MVP trophy back there. I got to do something with that. Anyway, we're going to add this to the shelves. So we're going to do this like, you know, these shelves are going to sort of grow over the years with stuff that we get. So, we'll figure this out later exactly where they go. But so thank you, Tim, and Virtualization Group Boston for providing the shield, which is now a permanent fixture in our studio. But what was interesting about this user group meeting was that it was a general virtualization group. So it wasn't just desktop virtualization. There's a lot of server folks in there and just kind of general, like IT generalists. And a lot of them hadn't seen me speak before. And I talked about a lot of the stuff we talk about it with VDI and where it's going and what all that. And I went outside after my session was over, and I had I stood at a table literally for 3 hours talking to all different people, just kind of chatting around. And a lot of them were sort of, you know, IT admins, desktop admins, and they were saying, like, you know, we don't know what to do because they have certain realities, like, you know, if we take user rights away, viruses stop. And if we, or they say, like, we want to help our users, but we don't even know what our users. We were talking about the FUIT thing, and they said, you know, a lot of users are doing this, but if we knew that they were all using Dropbox, we'd go figure out how to help them have Dropbox. Or if we knew they were using these things, we'd do that. But so there's all of these things, and I feel like you talk about these IT pros who are just doing things the way they always have been doing, protecting their jobs, which is true. But even if your heart is in the right place as an IT pro, yeah. I mean, how do you?
Yeah, so there is an article, I think, in Wired. Somebody sent me this morning. It's called IT Folks Are Ignorant in a Lot of Cases, right? So, I mean, my first reaction would be, really? You don't know your users are putting stuff in Dropbox and you're in IT? I mean, come on, let's be a little bit realistic, but on a more pragmatic level, right? So I think, look, at the end of the day, I think you're going to have more and more diversity in your client architectures. And I think the only way to deal with that is you're going to have to centralize your management. Irrespective of vendor, you know, whether it's app virtualization, whether it's user virtualization, it's image management, whatever, you're going to have to, because what's going to happen is you're going to end up with this massive amount of capability, complexity. And I think you then really have to translate that to, well, what problems are you solving with that? Right? In terms of Windows 7, I think we spoke about this at Briform last year, right? So if you're going to spend, this is your quote, and if you're going to spend all this money to upgrade to Windows 7, what are you getting for it? Right, and if you don't know the answer to that question, then I think you should perhaps go back to the drawing board and say, have you had the right conversations? And I think so. There's the Columbo questions, and then it cannot be distributed management in the way it's done today. It has to move to more of a user-centric model. Is my personal belief, right? It's irrespective of app sense. I'm not saying user virtualization has an app sense. I'm just saying people-centric, user-centric computing in general, because if you're at that model and you treat the user as the new primary key, and then you can go across multiple client architectures to provide more consistency, you then start to build the ability to provide more types of services, right? And so the more metadata that I think you understand around the user's experience, then you can apply that to the Dropboxes and stuff like that. And I think some of it you've got to engineer, frankly, right? Some of it you've got to build, right? If I was a SA or systems engineer, I'd start learning some development skills, right? There's a lot of the upgrading. Like, you can't just be a script kiddie doing, you know, and PowerShell by itself ain't good enough. So if you don't know what Node.js is, if you don't know a little bit of Objective-C, C++, I think the skill, so the standard, PC jockey is being commoditized heavily. So you're going to have to move to a higher value function.
So if I'm a desktop admin or desktop architect and... Right. I've got, you know, 100 or 1,000 users, and I've got SCCM. I'm just pushing out software and do my antivirus updates. You know, and you asked, you'd say, if you don't know why you're going to Windows 7, we have to go back to the drawing board. But I think I answer the question saying, well, I'm on Windows XP. It's really old. Microsoft is dropping support. We have to have stuff that's in support. So we're doing Windows 7, and I'm just kind of slogging along. So how do I break out of that?
I think you have to be one of the champions of change, right? If you really want to be of high value, leave that company, get a job somewhere else, frankly, right? Because I look, there's no easy answer. There's no silver bullet, right? I think, again, look, you're not going to be irrelevant tomorrow, right? But I think over time, all this stuff is going to be moved towards more centralized compute, right? Look at what Google's doing, what Apple's doing, what Microsoft is doing, right? Even Citrix and VMware, right? They're all moving towards a centralized compute model. And the only way you can consume centralized compute models, whether it's VDI or whether it's data services or whatever the case may be, is you've got to understand what you need to get to. So therefore, if you don't understand the context of what you're allowed to, what the rules are, and what you're trying to enable, you're kind of missing the point. Now, I did a lecture, actually, at my old university a couple of weeks ago, and there was a bunch of 18, 19-year-olds. Half of them were hungover when they walk in, right? And I said to them, look, if there's one lesson I can leave you with, if you're going to sleep through the rest of this lecture, is just understand the word context. And when I say context, I don't mean context in terms of policy and stuff. It's understand what the hell's going on in the world, right? And figure out how you are going to play in that world. Because if you don't ask yourself that question, you very quickly find yourself completely outskilled.
And I guess that applies to lots of industries over many centuries,
right?
Of work, but it's the same here.
I mean, look, just take a simple example, right? It's like, how long did we take to invent fire as a people, right? How long did it take us to invent the wheel? But then the transistor, the light bulb, computing, the internet. And that rate of change is getting faster. So to me, if you are sitting there and saying, I don't know what my opportunity is, sorry, you're asleep, right?
Yeah.
Wake up.
Yeah, you are this century's toll booth worker.
Right. It's going to get faster and faster and faster. And what you've got to do is figure out how to create value.
And look at how many years you have left in your career and do some math and figure out if you have to move or not.
And be excited.
Yeah.
There's so much opportunity. Like, I can't hire people fast enough. I can't find them. Right. And people, when I listen to the news and say, well, there's no jobs, there will be outsourced. I'm like, are you kidding me? Right. It's just that people are just not thinking, right, about the opportunity. Well, this is the rate of change is the fastest it's ever been, right? So why aren't we? Where are the innovators?
You know, it's interesting. I was speaking with someone who this weekend who is out of a job, and this person was talking about getting different certifications and that kind of stuff. But I wonder if you've and then that there's still difficulty in finding jobs. But I wonder if that's the same can be applied there. Is thinking about opportunities in terms of certifications versus thinking about where is IT going and where is the world going and how you can sort of intercept that.
I mean, I remember when I worked in downtown New York, downtown Manhattan, if I saw certification books being sold on Canal Street, that was time to get out of that market. Right? So that was. I remember once I even considered becoming an MCSE and I saw they're selling books on the street, so this is commoditized. So I think, look, at the end of the day, all of that stuff is good. Knowledge is good, right? But at the end of the day, you've got to build solutions. And the only way you're going to build solutions is by understanding what problems you're trying to solve.
And so we'll kind of start to wrap on that note. Incidentally, someone asked me, how does it feel not being an MVP anymore? Is it feeling naked? Well, so now I am officially not an MVP. I had an exit interview, actually. I am officially, they call it retired from the program.
How'd that go? So, Brian, why are you leaving the MVP program? Did you just send him a link?
I did. And, you know, I've had a different MVP lead. I mean, it changes every 3 months. So this person, I never met her before, and I think this is our first email back and forth about this. And so so she has some questions. She has like a questionnaire, and she's asking. And I sent her the blog post before, and she's asking these questions. And I'm kind of saying again, and she's like, you know what, I can probably fill in the rest of this on my own. but it's interesting because I can't remember if we talked about this on the show. I apologize if so. Like, I have been wanting to sort of leave the program for a little while for me personally. And it's the same thing. I got bad news for Citrix too, because it's happening with the CTP program, where for me in my career, NDA, having access to NDA information actually inhibits what I can do, because if I learn something under NDA, it doesn't help me. If I can't write about it, like, why know? And in the old days, we used to like want to like help Citrix and help Microsoft to make better products, but I don't care anymore. Because A, there's lots of competition, and if they, and like whether Citrix wins or VMware wins, I couldn't give a shit. And also, I don't feel that we have that. I mean, you know, people vote with their money and that kind of thing. So like a bunch of tech geeks who come down for pizza and beer once a year are not driving the direction of these multi-billion-dollar companies. And so so for me, you know, so I didn't. Which is fine. Like, it's a good program. And if I had customers, if I was consulting, if I was in-house, certainly it would be very important that I understood the long-term direction of the vendors that I'm putting a lot of faith into. So I'm not saying these are bad programs. I'm saying for me personally, it evolved to where it wasn't as important. So I was wanting to leave the program anyway. And then all the stuff, you know, and the OnLive thing, too. People made a big deal about how I was whining about OnLive and I quit because they wouldn't tell me about OnLive. And I mean, it was really just the whole thing with the direction Microsoft is going with the way they do video licensing. And I just think that the way they do licensing is really shady. And so I didn't want them having the website with like my picture and my name. Like, these are the champions who are championing our cause. And I'm like, I don't agree with anything they're doing in that regard. So
yeah, in that way, it's a liability. For us, and then the NDA speak as well too, because if we do learn something and we happen to bring it up, and then even if we came to that conclusion on our own, if we have an NDA and we break it, that's a liability too. So there's just, man, there were so many reasons that it made sense for you to get out of there.
Yeah, but I mean, I, you know, obviously my whole job is focused around Microsoft Windows. That isn't changing anytime soon. It looks like RemoteFX and RDP and Windows 8 is going to be amazing. So I'm not like saying that I'm going to diss them all the time, but It's just not the program for me. So, but hey, I still got my trophy on the wall back here, and I have not like thrown a garbage truck or ground it up. I was an MVP for 8 years, and that was, you know, those are fine times.
We could have done one of those Office Space, damn it feels good to be a gangsta kind of scenes where you're beating it like the fax machine.
Yeah, but in my luck, I would get a shard of glass in my eye and I would be blind.
So can you make? There's things that you stack on there for each year, right? Can you just make your own?
Like, well,
out of, you know, make them out of wood.
I think you're gonna put a line through the 2012.
Line. Yeah, yeah. Actually, here, let's put it upside down.
Yeah, put it upside down. Yeah.
With Sharpie.
There you go.
The cap. So, hey, we're about out of time. We're actually completely out of time. So let's kind of wrap up, I guess.
We have phase two as well.
Yeah, and so anyway, first of all, Harry, thank you for coming in today, thank you for sacrificing and missing the final of The Bachelor for us.
Tough, right? But sometimes
it
you
was
gotta
tough.
Do, gotta
yeah,
do
you gotta
job.
Make choices. No, thank you for having me on the show. And so again, like I said, we've been trying to schedule for a couple of months, so I apologize for my availability. But I'm glad we.
It worked out great. Now, so this phase two of our show. Now we're gonna talk about the Bri Forum sessions. I didn't discuss this ahead of time. I don't know if you're like taking off now, Harry.
No,
you,
I can hang out.
If you want to hang out,
I'll hang out. Go for it.
Yeah. Yeah. So you can be the peanut gallery.
The extra commentary.
So okay, I don't know. We should roll right into this, Gabe. Right? Is there anything else we need to?
I would say so. You know, we're not really a professional show here, so what the hell? Let's just no production. Let's just go right into it.
Okay. So and I guess so. This year, so Kevin Goodman was visiting. Last week, and he visited me and Benny Trish was here, and we kind of hung out for the weekend. And Kevin was here during the time we were picking the Bri Forum sessions, and it was cool because since he quit VMware, he's now an impartial, independent person. So we're like, great, you can join our jury and be part of this. And Kevin was actually, I think if I can speak on his behalf, was sort of.
Blown away?
I don't want to say, yeah, like, he was shocked that there's actually a lot of work that went into it, and it wasn't just, we're looking at our friends and all this kind of stuff, because we took tons of pictures of how we do the process, you know, we do the, Gabe and I both vote yes, no, maybe, we combine those lists together, we legitimately don't look at who the speakers are ahead of time, we look at just titles and descriptions, and we scrub them so there's any references to speakers that are removed, we put all the ones, I actually printed them out on paper. And had them all on the conference room table and was kind of sorting them around and grouping them and trying to really figure out to the people in the chat room. Yes, Kevin has left VMware. I think 2 weeks ago he was a guest on the show, or maybe 3 weeks ago. So you can hear the details there. And so it was we were looking at survey data because we asked the audience to give their opinions on what they like. We looked at speaker data from last year. We looked at all sorts of things. And we now have our list. Incidentally, so this is for Briveform London, which is May, I want to say 24th and 25th.
23rd and 24th.
23rd and 24th. So the sessions we're looking at right now are the sessions for London in May. We will announce the sessions for Chicago literally the week after London. So you're welcome to submit sessions now. Actually, I don't even know if we have the website open.
No, it's not open yet. We're still a ways out there. So we're looking at mid-April before we open up call for papers for that.
Okay, yeah. And the idea, by the way, so if you weren't accepted to London, then we will, you can resubmit for Chicago. And most of the sessions, some of them we had to get rid of right off the bat.
Even if you were accepted in London, you still have to resubmit for Chicago.
Right, yeah.
If you submitted, you have to submit again.
And so when will the Briveform 2011 videos be posted up here? They were posted like 6 months ago. So go to brianmadden.com/videos and you see them all there. And we actually post some of them every day onto the homepage too to highlight. We pick a different one sort of to highlight. And let's see. So I don't know how to go through this. Like we should, Gabe, I printed out the list that was based on a spreadsheet in Dropbox. I don't know if this is the same order. My order, the one I have, starts with Tim Mangan.
Tim, yep, that works for me.
So how do you, so
this is the one from Dropbox? So it's the same one I have. So I guess what the hell, right? First session is Tim Mangan's "The Top 13 Ways Microsoft Uses Caching to Improve Performance," and we should pull up the results of that survey that we did of all the people. Once we knew what the sessions were, we put them into a survey and let the community vote to get an idea that helped us decide when some sessions were on the bubble and things like that. And this is one of those sessions, I think, that was through the roof. Yes, we have to have this. We picked it anyway. But then when we went back and looked at the survey, we're like, holy shit. Yeah, we got to keep this session. So people are excited about this one.
Yeah. And this is a good one that has, a lot of takeaway value. And I didn't even know. So I had dinner with Tim and his wife and his son. Tim's son, by the way, I think his name is Patrick. He's now sequencing applications for hire also. So I had dinner with them last week and when I was in Boston. And they he said this was going to be, I think his session started like the five ways that Microsoft uses caching to improve performance. And this is just like internal Windows stuff, like the way it caches memory and calls and all sorts of things. So that's that's our first session. Next one is Brandon Schell with his session on PowerShell, Notes from the Field. And I don't remember. I think
this is a bit of an update because Brandon, we normally accept his, introduction to PowerShell, that kind of a thing. And what we learned also from this community survey was that, people pretty much, PowerShell is just part of the everyday life now. And so for you and I, we don't ever use it. So we're like, yeah, okay. Anything new I can learn about it. Great. But so for a lot of people, PowerShell is just part of their everyday life. And so if they need to learn something about PowerShell from the introductory level, they can just go back to the 2011 videos and watch it for free. So we're stepping it up a bit. And we accepted the PowerShell Notes from the Field session just so that we can take a deeper look about how to use PowerShell to manage server-based computing environments.
The next session is, the title is 10 Ways My Users Said F-U-I-T.
I think I put 11 whys, for yeses.
Yes. Well, some accuse this presenter of pandering because it was kind of fluid in the title. But this is by David Stafford, who is at VMware, and the policies for people who work at vendors this year are the same they always have been, which people who work at vendors are more than welcome to submit. They just can't submit about their actual topic. So like Dave Stafford could not submit on like why Vue is awesome. But this 10 ways my user said FUIT, he's actually going through like his experience. And he was at Cisco for years before he joined VMware, I don't know, a year or two ago. I met him actually. So Dave Stafford, I met him for the first time in person in New York City. We were doing some customer dinner. And he was sort of the VMware speaker. And I listened to him talk, and he gave his presentation, and I agreed with like 90% of it. And for me, watching something that VMware says, the same as for Citrix, frankly, also, that's very high. So I was like, wow, this guy's this guy's got it. I mean, I liked what he said a lot. And so so I had dinner with him, and it was cool to meet him, and we were talking about Briform and stuff like that. But this session actually is, I think this is a good eye-opening thing for people who are, you know, like maybe in denial about the FUIT thing. Like, this is just a list of war stories of like things that users have done to get around the policies that their IT people have put in place, which is kind of fun.
You're going to leave this next one on me, aren't you? So here's one of the ones that I believe is he's Swedish, and I don't know how to say his name. I'm going to go with Nick Callen. I'm sure that's 100% wrong. But this session is the ultimate ATV 4.x deployment. And what was cool about this one to us was that this is about how to set up ATV in your environment to kind of organize an application virtualization solution for your organization. So this is how to set up the infrastructure, how to deploy the clients, intro to sequencing, that kind of a thing. So entry level, how to get on the ATV train, which we'll follow up later with another one that's a little bit deeper.
And then the next one, incidentally, the agenda will be posted soon. Gabe, have you worked? This is one of Gabe's.
I made the agenda. The agenda should be posted very shortly onto Briform.com. I can also post it. I'll put at least a session list on BrianMadden.com here in the next 24 hours.
Okay, so the next session, and I've lost my screen, Justin, if you don't mind real quick. This little chat window, you have to touch it every 25 minutes or else it goes away. So next one is about HTML5, the new application platform. And this is an interesting session. So this session is by
Dan Shapir, right?
Dan Shapir. And he works at Ericom. And a lot of you know Dan Shapir as a guy who always comments in our – he doesn't do it so much anymore, but he used to comment a lot on BrianMadden.com, and we feel like he was always a shill. He was always the guy who's like, with Ericom, you can do this, or with Ericom, you can do that. And like, we felt like every time he was talking, he was selling us something. So the reason though why we accepted the session, again, is because – so Ericom makes an HTML5 – RDP client, and we talked about that earlier. But what Dan's session is about is not about the RDP clients in HTML5. It's about if you actually develop applications. Like, there's all this talk about, hey, are HTML5 apps going to replace Windows apps, and is that the new platform? So he's looking at, if you're an application developer, sort of what's the difference between an HTML5 app and like a native Windows app or a platform native, you know, iOS app or whatever. So what can they do? What can't they do? Where they work, when they don't work? And that's going to be, like, this is a session that personally I'm interested in because I'm not a developer. And he's not doing this for developers. He's doing it for SEs like me who are like, we read these things from real developers and they're like, oh, HTML5 is going to replace the world. And is that true? I don't know. So he's got the experience as an HTML5 developer, having built that client, but it's not about their client. It's about HTML5 in general and what that means for developers. So I think that's going to be pretty cool.
I like somebody called me for saying I made the agenda, like I'm Al Gore saying I invented the internet. but I literally
but this is actually true though.
The Word document that has the sessions on it in some order. So
do you know?
I'm calling that.
We always joke about how, like, Brian, like, I am the guy who's, like, on stage waving his arms like an idiot, and Gabe's the guy at home doing the actual work. And this is another instance of why that is true, where every year, I think almost, like, since, I don't know, for the probably past 6, 7, 8 Bri forums, like, some poor son of a bitch has to actually look at all the agenda, look at the sessions, look at these speakers can't be here on these days. This guy wants to speak before lunch. This guy wants here. This guy's leaving. We got to have two sessions and not compete against each other. We want to have mixing so we've got different levels. We don't want to make it so one speaker has all their sessions in the same day. All that kind of stuff. That giant juggling game is one of Gabe's 1,000 thankless jobs at our company.
Gabe, did you use a whole bunch of little sheets of paper with all the sessions written on them?
No, I used to. There's a photo, actually, of me sitting there with a bottle of, I don't know, it was at Brian's bar in D.C., his basement, with a bottle of liquor and looking pretty ragged after being up all night trying to create the agenda. Now I just throw shit out there, and if it doesn't work, we figure that out later. But we've got it simplified, but I have lost a lot of hair since 2007. So, but yeah, that it's a real process for sure, but it's... it's fine. It's just one of those things. It has to be done. So up next is the follow-up to the add-on to that other app V1 that sets up your AppV environment is this one's from Kevin Kaminsky, who is from Calgary, and this is called Advanced Sequencing with AppV. And so this is Kevin's bread and butter. Like every time I've seen this guy, he's he's at the Microsoft Management Summit. I see him with Tim Mangan, and obviously Tim's a big AppV guy. So so Kevin is the dude to give you advanced sequencing information for AppV. And so we're gonna kind of set it up with the ultimate AppV deployment, and then we'll knock it down with advanced sequencing.
And then the next one is a session that
so excited for this one.
Yeah, we really didn't want to accept this session, but we had to, which is from a friend of the show, Nathan Cotino, and his session is Demystifying Microsoft Licensing for Client Virtualization Environments. And I think Nathan,
Jack, what's the background for this one? Because Jack is the one that
this is the one. I think I told this story a while ago. I had emailed him to clarify a few questions. I thought it'd be a short email, but little did we know. I'd emailed him to clarify a few questions about VDA and BYOD, and then that turned into a phone call. And then later that night, he sends me another email, and he's like. There's so much more that I found. We need to talk more about this tomorrow. And then, like, 11 o'clock at night, so we're talking, like, 1 a.m. his time, I get one last email, and he's like, this stuff is so crazy. Can I still submit a Briform session?
Well, and another piece of background is during this whole OnLive debacle with the license at Microsoft going after them, someone contacted me saying that they believed that that if you have OEM licenses, you can actually provide VDI as a service with Windows 7, because the OEM license agreement, when you break that seal with new hardware, it says something along the lines of, this license agreement is the ultimate license agreement, and all the other bundled software, your license agreement is with us on these terms, not with whatever that vendor may say the license is. And this person felt that OEM licenses could be used to provide Windows 7 access as a service. And this person sent me an analysis of they ultimately did not end up acting on this, but an analysis with their working with lawyers and what they feel like might be true. And I sent that also to Nathan, just kind of asking him what he thought. And he said essentially also that, well, Microsoft was really caught off guard with the language once virtualization in general came into play, and he wouldn't be surprised if this was the case, if there was loopholes there. So this licensing thing, man.
He wouldn't have been surprised if there were loopholes before, but those have been tightened up now with Windows 7.
Okay. Yeah. And interestingly, though, it's weird that we like to think that Briform, we talk about a lot of cutting edge technologies and cutting edge topics. And it's interesting that licensing would be one of those, like that something humans invented, like lawyers, and we're having very cutting edge licensing topics at Briform. But Nathan's is always one of the most popular sessions, and I expect we'll be again this year.
We like cutting edge, but we also like to bitch. So, that's we're fulfilling the other need at this point. Up next is this is a staple now, right? But they keep diving deeper into it each year. This is Benny Trish and Sean Bass with their remoting multimedia and interactive graphics applications. This is Remote Effects, HDX, PC over IP. This is Sean and Benny put these things to the test years ago. They came up with a chart that rated each one of them in given situations, and so they're taking that one step further and looking, I believe, at I can't remember. Now I have to read this thing. Do you remember what it is, Brian?
What do you mean, what they're looking at? RDP, Remote Effects, HDX, Teradici.
Nah, phase three was going to dive in a little bit deeper to something else, but now I lost my screen here.
Audio, video, and high-end graphics is what their focus is for this time around. And speaking of bitching,
before it was just overall experience, and so now they're diving into very specific areas. That's what it was.
Yeah. And we know their session's good because all the vendors complain about how unfair their tests are. And it's funny but they hear that from everyone, so we like that. Incidentally, speaking of vendors, so Thomas Poppelgaard's asking about why isn't Citrix a sponsor of Briform anymore. Well, Citrix was there last year, and I don't know if they're a sponsor this year or not. Now that Gabe and I work...
This is the best part of... Yeah.
Yeah, we have nothing to do with sponsorship. So TechTarget, we're like 650 employees. We have, I don't know, like 100 sales reps or something, and they go out and sell Briform sponsorships. One thing I will say is I get an internal email like weekly that kind of shows all the sponsors of Briform. Like, we got these ones are in it gold, these are in it silver, platinum, whatever. And there's a lot more on that list than are actually on the Briform website, because once they sign the contract, then we have to collect the deliverables from them, and that process just, you know, who knows how long that takes for it to happen. So I don't know whether Citrix is a sponsor this year or not. I know they were as recently as last year. They were at both of them. But for all these companies now, you know, not my job. So the sponsors of Briform, when I walk the floor at Briform, that's when I go, oh, you're here. Oh, hey, cool. Oh, hey. And that's I walk in just like everyone else does and find out who the sponsors are. So my job with Briform is to work out the content and the overall sort of direction of the event. And but all those logistical details are done by other people, which is awesome. Okay, so our next session, also from Benny Tritch, is exploring the secrets of RemoteFX. And this is one of the ones that I can definitely thank Kevin and Twitter for, because Benny's basically is talking about, you know, RemoteFX. So what's the difference between RDP and RemoteFX, especially in Windows 8, when, like, did they just change the name? So now everything is being called RemoteFX. So it's kind of digging into RemoteFX and Windows 8 RemoteFX and remoting and what that was all going to be like. We got the same session submission from a guy at Microsoft, the same guy, I forget his name right now, who did the session at Build on announcing all the new features of RemoteFX and Windows 8. And so at first I was going to accept that session from him because I thought, well, you know, he's the guy that wrote it. That's cool. But then we got the same session from Benny, and I'm like, oh, we don't need both of these. And then Kevin's like, well, why are you accepting the Microsoft session? Like, isn't that guy breaking the rules? And I was like, well, yeah, I guess I never thought of that. Microsoft, in the past, we've given an exception to because they were Microsoft, so it's all about Windows. And so, like, they apply to everyone equally. But in this case, RemoteFX, they're competing against these other people. And yeah, like, that was a good point that Kevin kind of pointed out. And frankly, we asked Twitter, by the way, like, okay, who should present, Microsoft guy or Benny? And the answer was like,
overwhelmingly
100
Benny.
To 0, Benny.
Yeah. So, I think a Microsoft guy said Microsoft. But
So that's cool. So Benny will talk about RemoteFX. All right, next up.
The aforementioned Kevin Goodman. I'm super excited about this one too. And this one, based on the title, this one I knew who it was when I was going through this, even though I had hidden the author or the presenter column. And the title of this is "What 2 years of living in the trenches has taught Kevin Goodman about VDI." And I think in the abstract this wasn't in there, but I think in some other field in the survey that he filled out, he wrapped up the session by saying what to consider before embarking on a VDI death march. And so this session is basically what Kevin hates about VDI, having been dealing with VDI and kind of living in the belly of the beast for the last few years.
Yeah. And
which, I mean, come on. This is Kevin, too. It's so frank. Like, it's going to be such an honest conversation. Kevin is nothing if not candid.
But he's also good about tying it back to real stuff. So we don't want to have a 75-minute bitch fest because we don't need him for that. We're quite capable of that on our own. Thank you.
We often call Kevin when we need a reality check.
Well, yeah, and so, this is, man, Kevin not working in a vendor. I love that, Kevin. and so I don't know how long we're going to have him for in that capacity. But because, you know, we got that book coming out. He read our book because we were talking about it. And he's like, yeah, you know, I got time now. Send it over. So
just hire him to sit at home and wait for our call.
Well, this is now the second company he's like sold and retired from. So I don't know how long we'll get him to last this time. But I'm looking forward to what he's writing about. All right. So next session is going to be from Vincent Branger, the French Citrix independent consultant, and his session is going to be about WAN acceleration. In his submission, actually, I don't know if I emailed him. So Vincent, if you're listening, take notes. The title is called "Branch Repeater and Other WAN Accelerators for Desktop Virtualization," and we want this session, but we don't want it to be focused on Branch Repeater. Branch Repeater, of course, is Citrix's WAN accelerator. So we want to focus it on WAN acceleration in general, where it works, where it doesn't work. Maybe get into some details of how these different things, compare to each other. And in his description, he talked about, Silver Peak.
He talked about Silver Peak, yeah, Riverbed.
And, yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah. So, but we'll make sure that this is a WAN acceleration session in general, as opposed to one that's specifically focused on the Citrix products.
Also from Vincent is the security and client hypervisors session, which, this is something that normally we'd have from Torsten Root, but Torsten is his. I believe sometime in May is what they were told. His next child will be due, and so you know here in the U.S. we specify you will have this baby on this day, and in other countries they're just like yeah, second half of May.
That really
like
feels
that.
Like Torsten would be the kind of person though. They'd be like the baby will be born at 12, 14.
It's yeah. opposite, right? Yeah. So Vincent is going to do security and client hypervisors for us. And really this is about the Zen Client XT, next top, really the top client hypervisor in the space, and what kind of different security levels we can get with that using different hardware, different what security we can get with the hardware, with the hypervisor, the storage, all of this, and all the different places where we can secure client hypervisors.
All right, so the next one is from Mike Nelson. It's going beyond templates and clones. And this is take two of the session. He gave a session that was similar to this, Brian from 2011 in Chicago, and he's just completely redone the session with all the latest technologies. So it's basically about automating your OS deployments. So you know the whole like how do you create the perfect you know quote unquote golden image? All the different versions of Windows, the hardware, the templates. You know, can you apply the same images to physical and virtual? Looking into the free software like Microsoft Deployment Toolkit, mm-hmm. automated installation kits. And he says it's 10% slides and 90% demo. And I believe this is one of the highest rated sessions at Brian from last year, if I recall as well.
Yeah, yeah, and something that's exciting for us to see, just because you know it's not just about VDI, it's about traditional as well. But really, because it everybody wants to get to that kind of golden image, it's hard to do, and that's why people go to VDI. But there's other ways to do it too. So another Frenchman, Pierre Marmignon, is going to present. Stop talking about desktop transformation. Talk about the users and use cases. And if I'm not mistaken, Sean Bass is also a co-presenter on this one. And so this is, this is something that we've been talking about for a while now. This is everybody's focusing on VDI and talking about, you know, we have to get the best user experience and all of this stuff. But nobody's really, like, we forget that the users are king and they don't really need the whole desktop. They just need applications and they just need very specific things. And so it's more time to, this session is going to be about putting together what your actual needs are and then using that to deliver or put together the right solution.
This kind of falls in what we talked about with Harry earlier today.
Yeah, exactly.
So hopefully this is I'm looking forward to that. And by the way, and the fact that this came from Pierre. Pierre's spoken at Brightform in the past. He's an independent consultant as well. So when I first read a session moving beyond desktop transformation, I'm like, okay, this is some vendor bullshit. But the fact it comes from him, and it's moving beyond desktop transformation. It's not why we need desktop transformation. It's just like, man, cut the shit. What do we actually need to do, and how do we make that happen? So I like
this
that
is
a lot.
One of the this happens a lot too, where you're like, all right, I guess I'll accept this session, and you unhide the presenter category, and you're like, oh, thank God.
And we do by the way that where we hide the presenter, that's just the first pass, and once we start going, once we go through that first pass and then Gabe and I start to reconcile our lists, then we show the presenter, we look at feedback from last year, we look at the audience feedback from the survey, we sort of pull all that in to make the ultimate go and no-go
funny.
Decision.
We should unhide that column on the reveal show. So we've accepted all these sessions and we don't know who the authors are.
Well, you know, I actually...
We're learning right along with you, people.
I thought a little bit about... about video recording the actual conversation we had where we're negotiating back and forth about which sessions are going in and which ones aren't. The problem is that's like an 8-hour process, first of all.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of swear words. And probably there's, you know, I know you should never say anything that you don't want printed on the front page of the newspaper, but that would not be a good thing to record. But we try to keep it, we try to have good diversity. We try to balance out speakers who were popular in the past, as well as bringing in new faces. And I think we did that for this year. So next we've got Ian Parker, and his session is server performance troubleshooting and benchmarking. So a quick and easy way. And basically, it's this is sort of good hardcore. Like, this is like the roots of Brightform, you know, hardcore technical sessions. He talks about how a lot of organizations are not able to invest all the time and money into benchmarking. And if you have poor benchmarking, then your analysis, it can do you think it's bad hardware now, or do you think you just don't know what you're doing? And there's tools, how to use these, and just how do you get a hands? How do you wrap your head around what you can do to actually analyze your server performance and benchmark that, and kind of figure out how your environment stacks up towards what it should be able to stack up to?
Up next is a new one, right? A newcomer to Broadform, Dan Brinkman. I don't even know Dan. Well,
he was,
I guess,
a lightning
Dan was,
session last
Dan
year.
Dan presented in a lightning session last year. Yeah, so we're giving him a full session this time. So Dan is he's going to present. This is another one that we had. Yes. is how to fail at VDI, a step-by-step guide. And so he's going to take it tongue in cheek, but we know Dan, and it'll still be a very serious approach to talking about the ways that VDI projects fail. And this is something that Brian and I have talked about. We've done webcasts and podcasts and all sorts of different, you know, presentations about the ways that VDI projects fail. We talked about how Tim's list grew from 4 to 13 for the ways that Windows uses caching. This list for us started, I think, at 7 and has now grown to something
22, 23.
Like 24, 25. Yeah. So Dan submitted this, though, on his own. And it's funny because all the reasons are the same. Like, not what, you know, the VDI fails because you started this whole thing without knowing why the hell you were doing it in the first place, or assuming you were going to save money, or because the hardware vendor just told you that you need to, that you can do this, and so there's so many other reasons that the VDI projects fail, and Dan's going to take a look at those, which, I mean, it's, if nothing else, it'll be entertaining.
All right, next session is another one from Tim Mangan, and it's called "And Then There Was Power." It's the story of the Windows 7 boot. And I talked to him about this also when I had dinner. So he's just really – he says, you know, the Windows 7 operating system is a tremendous beast filled with magical tricks to improve or crush performance, like a cheese sandwich under a dancing elephant. So he's walking through the process of the boots in significant detail, everything that happens, what it's read. And then specifically, I talked to him to make sure this was actually had real-world applicability and not just trivia. So, you know, what can you use, especially with VDI and spinning up demand instances and imaging and all that kind of stuff. So what you need to know about what happens, what you can do to affect this, how it's really working, how you can troubleshoot it. And I also confirmed with him that he'll focus on – he wrote Windows 7 in the proposal submission, but we want him to look at Windows 7 and Windows 8. And he's just started looking at Windows 8. He said a lot of it is very similar, but there's a few key changes. And so he'll do that session covering both of those.
Sorry, I scrolled down and was making edits.
Ruben is next.
All right. So, this is one of three from Ruben. The first one here is an update from the one that we've had the past couple of years, and that's the VDI Smackdown 2012 and understanding the impact of storage in VDI. And so Ruben will go through. He talks about all the different, you know, mainstream VDI packages out there. And that's actually only about half the presentation, because the storage aspect is something that Ruben spent so much time talking about, writing white papers and things like that. They've been posted on brianmadden.com. And so he's really going to get into what the impact of storage on VDI is. And, even if you've seen this thing before, it's been updated for each year that it's been given. So it should be a little fresh this year, too.
The next one from Ruben is called "An Insider's Guide to Virtualization, a Virtual Reality Check." So this one is Ruben and Ruben Vendekamp. This is their project of VRC, where they're looking at, they benchmark and publish their results of different virtualization platforms and just the performance. And they've presented this session the last few years. And every year they focus on a different area. So, of course, it's up to date with newest hardware, newest products, newest versions. This year they're going to look at specifically the best practices and performance impact on Windows 7, on Microsoft's Forefront antivirus, and then the best practices and performance impact of Server 8 and Server 8 Hyper-V and Server 8 RDS and VDI. So that's always a popular session, and we're looking forward to that.
And the last one from Ruben, and we didn't even ask him if we could do all three of the ones he accepted. But I mean, there was one year, I think it was 2008, Ruben submitted 5 sessions and we accepted them all. And he asked never to have 5 again. So in this case, we have 3. So we have heeded his wishes. this one's titled, though, "Demonstration Gone Wild, Windows 8 Sneak Preview." And the abstract for this is, in this freaking awesome demo, Ruben Sprout will show the latest developments in Windows Client 8 and desktop virtualization. So he's going to go into he's going to dig deeper into Windows 8 than maybe we all did when we threw up threw it into our VMware workstation or VMware Fusion. And so this is the typical Ruben approach. This guy doesn't do anything half-assed, so it'll be pretty awesome.
And his thing too, like when it's demo, he's not demoing. I mean, by the time Briform happens, Windows 8 was available to the world for 3 or 4 months. So he's not going through like, oh, here's Metro and look, you can touch it. But rather, he's looking at the whole infrastructure of that. So SCVMM 2012, Windows Server 8, Hyper-V on Server 8, the remote desktop virtualization hosts on Server 8. So it's really digging into all those back-end server components that we deal with for delivering desktops, not just ARM tablets with Metro.
And I'm going to cut you off before you get to the next one, because we're not actually doing that one. It was another one that Sean Bassett submitted, but he's already got two. He's got enough. He has to be out of this one and submit it to Chicago. So we're not going to we will not announce that one. So there that actually leaves us with we've got some lightning round sessions to choose from that we have not selected yet. So if your name wasn't called, there's still a chance that we will call you. And we do have a couple of other sessions that we need to fill once we figure out the lightning rounds and all of that. So there's still a chance.
And so, yeah, okay, so here's the – right, because we've got – like I haven't announced my session. Gabe has not announced his session. Jack, we haven't announced your session. We talked about your session, though. Jack, tell us what you're talking about.
It's going to be mobile device management related and mobile application management related. The original focus of like exclusively looking at the solutions that compare like BYOD solutions that allow for like a BYOD personal work separation. It's probably going to be broader than that, because that actually is less of a big deal than I thought it would be.
The fact that like to allow people to have work and personal separate on the same device, but now it's into policy enforcement and
yeah.
you're talking mobile devices. So you're talking about iOS yeah. and Android and all that.
Yeah. And this can go into things like the hypervisors on the phones and things like that, too. It can be just, ways that people are yeah. managing the devices.
Yeah. Well, like, I thought the hypervisors on the phone would be a big story, but it turns out that it's not.
Because they're crazy.
And we can get into why. Yeah.
Yeah. So that'll be like a two-minute long, like, subsection.
Or a giggle.
Of laughing. Why that's insane.
Right.
So we had upwards of 80 sessions submitted. I think it was 78 or something like that. There was a lot of consumerization sessions that we turned down, because it's still Briform after all. And so this is still a desktop virtualization show. And so we've got the MDM from Jack. We've got the FUIT session from David Stafford. So we wanted to have a little bit of an element there, because it sort of is in our space, but we didn't really want to turn Briform into a consumerization conference. But if you'd be willing to travel to a consumerization conference, maybe we can start to put one of those together as well. But that's why you're not seeing a ton of consumerization though with this show, even though it seems like something we would do.
Well, and the stuff we're covering for consumerization also ties back specifically to what those of us who attend Briform have to deal with. So, like, yeah, you mentioned, like, BYOC is stuff we cover, BYOD, and how we deal with the fact most of us who are delivering desktops are also working with, how we work out with users who are doing their own things. We talk about the FUIT and that kind of stuff. So, I'm sure that my session will end up being a consumerization related session at some point. I did a session last year, which is sort of the consumerization of IT, where I outlined, as Kevin Goodman said, I created this dragon in the first 60 minutes of the session. And then in the last 15 minutes, I said, so does anyone know what we can do about this thing? and in the past year, I've been really
thinking. I think we have a lot more answers now.
We do. Yeah. So I think we'll look at that sort of thing. So Gabe mentioned we've got the lightning round sessions to work out, to announce those. Those are where we have four 15-minute sessions in one block. So there's topics that we thought were really cool topics, but we're like, I'm not listening to this for an hour and 15 minutes. And so there's a bunch of those that will.
We have to iron those out, and there's some logistical issues too with getting those set up, and then there's actually a couple other slots too that we actually have a list of bubble sessions that we're going to have to go back through and scrutinize a little bit more to see if we want them to be lightning round or not lightning round or that kind of a thing. So we have a little bit more work to do, and then maybe in the next week, 10, 14 days.
Yeah, we'll make it real soon, because this is happening. The conference is happening pretty fast, like 2 months and a week or so. But the thing is, we also have, I think, one or two slots remaining open so that when we announce the session list on the website, and if there's mass response of like, hey, idiots, why didn't you have this kind of session? And we're like, oh, yeah, we forgot about that. Right. So we left ourselves with like a safety slot of, I think, one or two sessions that we can backfill with. So that is that's it, I think, right, for Bri Forum.
Yeah, that's it for that. 40 minutes it took to announce all those. But this was fun. I like this better than doing the videos because we can talk a little bit back and forth about it. And last year we tried to do a video for this, and I think it was more effort than it was worth. But this podcast format for this I like.
Well, we're on video right now too, so we can – oh, no?
Well, but it was a higher production video or production value kind of thing last year. If you remember, we had PowerPoint that we were screen recording, and it was much more complex than this.
Yeah.
I'm wearing a hoodie and a hat right now.
All right. Hey, well, I think we're done. So to all of you who listened today, thank you for joining. Thank you all to those who submitted sessions. We'll be in touch with details around what happens next at Bri Forum, and we'll be in touch with the Lightning Round soon. Thanks to Harry for being our guest and for sticking around. Thank you, Gabe, Jack, et cetera, et cetera.
Actually, you know what? Harry, do you think we're missing anything? I forgot Harry was there. He's been so quiet.
I actually think the whole consumerization thing is more important than you know, hey, stupid, you missed it. That would be my comment, right? I think it's bigger than you think.
Yeah.
I think it's front and center of people's mind. They're trying to figure out how to deal with it in the context of work. And I think it's a worthy conversation because going back to what we talked about in terms of what does this mean for my job? Well, actually, if you could help people figure out how to deal with that problem, I think you add a lot of value.
Maybe that's a session you want to do.
That means I'm going to go to London, right? perhaps we should talk about that.
Chicago. You could do Chicago in July if you don't want to go to...
Yeah, perhaps we should think about that. And, you know, I want to do it as an independent session if I do it.
Of course. Or this could be something like, I want to do something with consumerization on my session, so maybe I can consult with you, even if you don't go and present.
Yeah, I'm happy to help.
We can put our heads together over some beers.
Yeah. And if I'm there, if you just want me to come up and just kind of give you an alley-oop, that's fine too.
Yeah. I have been able to miss the alley-oop sometimes, but I'll go for it. So, well, great. Well, hey, thank you so much for joining today, and thank you all for listening, and we will speak to you all next week from San Francisco. Thanks.
Sounds good.